the court's ready to proceed. Are you? Perfect. How are you, Mr. Capone?
Your Honor, I'm fine this morning so far. Good morning to you all on the court. May it please the court. This morning I plan to discuss the suppression issue regarding my client's spontaneous statement to the two New York City police officers. If I have enough time, I'm also going to discuss the 3507 statement. And if you have questions about any other issue, I'll be happy to answer them. Andrew Brown, age 17, was apprehended in New York City by a fugitive task force 2 months after he was indicted in this case. When he was captured, the New York City officers who caught him contacted Wilmington police officer DeClemente and told her that they had him in custody. This was about 6:30 or so in the morning. DeClemente got in her car, headed up to Brooklyn. And by the time she arrived, Brown had been in the custody of these New York City officers for about 5 hours without saying anything about this case. DeClemente then questioned her for about an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Now, does the record reflect that she was alone with him or was anyone from the New York Police Department present?
The record reflects that she was alone with him in the room.
Okay.
Within minutes of the conclusion of that interrogation, Brown made a spontaneous statement to the New York City officers, which is an issue here. Now, I filed a motion to suppress in this case, seeking to suppress the statement he made to DeClemente, as well as the spontaneous statement to the New York City police officers. A hearing was set for the motion, but the state never responded to the motion. And as we entered the courtroom to begin the hearing, the court was advised, as was I, that the prosecutor was not going to contest the suppression of the statement to DeClemente, but they were contesting the suppression of the spontaneous statement to the New York City police officers. And these two New York City police officers were the only witnesses who testified during this hearing. When I got the chance to cross-examine these officers, my first questions to them were framed to determine whether Brown's statement had really been spontaneous or whether it had been the result of an interrogation of Brown by these two New York City officers. Of interest to me was why Brown would make such a damaging statement without having any prompting whatsoever by these two New York City officers. So I asked them, did he say anything to you during those 5 hours? And they said no. And then I asked them, why didn't you ask him any questions during those 5 hours? You knew you arrested this guy on a murder charge. Why didn't you ask him anything? And they said, well, we don't question juveniles, and the guy had he'd been indicted. We don't question people once they've been indicted. In fact, we don't question when a warrant has been issued because it violates their Sixth Amendment rights. So as far as we were concerned, it was a hands-off situation here. The trial judge believed that the statement that he made to these two officers was spontaneous. Now, I'm asking the court to contrast that to the activities of Officer DeClemente. She drives up there. She gets there. She questions him for 2 hours. Now, the prosecutors admit that her questioning at least violated his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. But I submit that she also violated his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, as well as family court rules which require that she at least make an attempt to contact his parents before she conduct any interrogation of him. None of those things happen in the case.
Now, tell the court, are they three alternative arguments that all get you to the same result, or do we need to connect them to get you to where you want to be? Or is the Sixth Amendment your primary argument?
Sixth Amendment is my primary argument, but I believe the Fifth and Sixth Amendment arguments are very similar. But the reason why I mention all three of those is because this was, I think it goes to the extreme nature or the lack of care, the lack of respect that DeClemente exhibited towards my client's rights.
Well, what difference does that make? I mean, In the sense that the state has conceded that point, and now we're talking about what arguably is a totally different set of circumstances, namely he's in a car with two different people and spontaneously makes a comment that's damaging.
Here's why I think it makes a difference. The more egregious, I think the more egregious her behavior becomes, the less chance they have, the state has, to come before the court and say that she scrupulously honored his rights. What I'm trying to show the court is she scrupulously...
But again, are we talking about what she did here, or are we talking about what happened in the police car with two different people in, you know, arguably totally different circumstances?
Well, that's why I'm thinking that it's... I'm going to argue now that it wasn't arguably different circumstances. There was a linkage here, and it was a temporal linkage. It was moments after she finishes with him. He's now... She's in a room. He's in a room one-on-one with this officer from New York for an hour and a half. And within moments, the testimony was within moments, he's in a car. Now he's locked in a car with the two New York City police officers who arrested him. And he says to them, the statement.
Right. Well, 2 points. Number one, going back to your egregiousness argument, mm-hmm. did Officer DiClemente know that there had been an indictment?
I believe she did.
Well, does the record show you she did? I mean, what is it that makes it egregious? If she didn't know, then that would be less egregious than if she did know.
Your Honor, I'm afraid I can't point to a spot in this record that shows that she did. But she was the chief investigating officer in this case. She had to, it had to be presented to a grand jury to get an indictment.
That may be, and it may be the fact that she knew, but does the record show it? I mean, what are you basing your egregiousness characterization on?
The fact that he'd been indicted and that she had questioned him.
Except we don't know that she knew.
The record shows New York picked him up because New York knew he was wanted in Delaware. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So he's wanted in Delaware because either an arrest warrant has issued as a result of the indictment or for some other reason. But those are the two choices, right?
That's right. But at the suppression hearing, during the trial, the prosecutor conceded he was indicted. She had no right to question him. That was the prosecutor's concession during this case, which led me to believe that he knew and she knew that it was an indictment.
Your other point was that within moments he made the spontaneous statement.
Right.
But it's more than moments,
well,
isn't it, to get out of a room, to walk into a car, for the car to be put into motion. We're talking at least minutes, aren't we, not seconds.
Well, I think the court said it happened within 5 to 10 minutes after he left the room.
5 to 10 minutes.
Right.
Okay. So your argument, as I understand it, is the New York police had him. She questioned him for a couple of hours. 5 minutes later, he's in the car. And that the reason the two are linked, although they didn't preface their remarks, it appears that what your client did was say, and by the way, that police officer from Wilmington got it wrong, and continued with the conversation. And so your argument, as I understand it, is that the conversation was with the New York police officers was a continuation by way of explanation of the conversation he was just having with the Wilmington police officer.
That is it. In other words, had he not had that conversation with the Wilmington police officer, he would not have made those statements to the New York City police officers. So there wasn't that break in events that the state needs to show that this statement is now admissible.
So if she would have honored his rights, no conversation would have occurred, and he wouldn't have been saying to the New York police officers, by the way, she had it wrong.
That's my point.
Would your argument be the same if we changed the facts slightly and assumed that it was, say, 20 minutes after the interrogation by Officer DiClemente terminated?
Well, at some point, I guess there's a tipping point. And my argument would be that 5 minutes is not the tipping point. But here's the argument I'd like to make to you. When we were at the suppression hearing, the prosecutor had to address my argument. I was making the pitch that why would he say such a damaging thing without being questioned by the police officers? And I knew that the judge was never going to believe that these officers questioned him. But my pitch was, why would he say such a thing? And this is what the prosecutor said. He said, the reason why I think he said those things, in all probability, was he was still fired up about the interrogation. So, if he's still fired up about the interrogation, that means to me there hasn't been a sufficient break in time. If he was still fired up about the interrogation 20 minutes later, I would argue that wasn't enough time to cause the break. And in this case, it was only 5 minutes, and the prosecutor pretty much conceded the reason why I think he said this was he was fired up. So if there's not a if there's not a break sufficient to cleanse the constitutional violation, it should be suppressed. And I think that's what we have here.
And is that argument, would you be making that argument whether Detective DiClemente knew or didn't know that there had been an indictment before she actually interrogated Mr. Brown?
I could make that indictment because I could make that argument on Fifth Amendment grounds and on the family court rule grounds. But when the prosecutor comes in and says, Your Honor, he was indicted, she shouldn't have been asking questions, I think that the concession is there. I apologize for not being able to point to a spot in the record. I just never thought that that was an issue. I just accepted or presumed that that she was aware that he had been indicted.
Let's assume for the moment that the court is willing to accept this argument.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't that be a harmless error?
Well, why wouldn't it be a harmless error? Because the other evidence against my client was a group of the most unbelievable witnesses. When I say unbelievable, I don't mean in terms of their credibility, but I guess it's related to that. The most bizarre group of witnesses I've ever come across in one case. And they were all over the place in terms of their testimony. And they needed corroboration. And the corroboration from these people came from these police officers. I mean, these were crack addicts, people who changed their story on the stands, people who didn't want to be in court, people who claimed that they'd been threatened to make these statements by the police. So they were less than credible witnesses. They were less than stellar witnesses. So what gave these people credibility was the fact that these two New York City officers came in and said, this is what he told me. And what he told me, what he told them, supported the state's theory of what these people said during their 3507 statements. Therefore, I think that it's not a harmless error. The case was not overwhelming otherwise. There was no physical evidence linking it to the case. It was these eyewitnesses who really didn't see the shooting, who didn't want to be there, and there was this confession. That's why I don't think it's harmless error.
Now, when we look at your argument on voluntariness of the 3507 statements and the threat of incarceration, was the suggestion of incarceration related to being held as a material witness, or were there other charges that were being held over the people's heads?
Well, according to the testimony of these witnesses, there were other charges, and the other charges were hindering prosecution. And these women were two crack addicts. They didn't want to be in jail, and they surely didn't want to be away from their access to crack cocaine. The police, according to their testimony, look, Joanne Brown said, you know, I'm tired of getting locked, being threatened by locked up. I've been locked up all my life. I don't want to keep hearing you talk. You're all going to lock me up if somebody don't talk. I don't have to talk to you about nothing. These people were threatened by going to jail. And the trial judge pretty much accepted that because she said, I appreciate that, you know, I believe that they were told that they're going to be held in jail. She said, but the law is that they can be put in jail for material witness warrants. But we weren't at that stage yet. We weren't at that stage. And so I believe that the judge's statement of the law is not entirely accurate. And be that as it may, a police officer can't issue a material witness warrant. Only a neutral magistrate can issue a material witness warrant. So there is some level of due process there before that is going to issue. And in this case, these two crack addicts were contacted at their house. The police came to the house and said, if you don't come down, we're going to get you for hindering arrest and God knows what else. Because I'm sure had there been any greater investigation, they could have found a myriad of reasons to arrest these people and bring them into jail and keep them there. So,
did either of them testify about anything that would circumstantially incriminate your client on the stand, or were all of their incriminating statements in the 3507 statements?
They were all over the place on the witness stand. And I'll be very frank with the court. I don't know what the jury made of their behavior. I really don't know. It was extremely bizarre. The most damaging, so if you're looking at what came out of their mouths, I would say that the most damaging thing that came out of their mouths came out in the 3507 statements. But I can't tell you what their appearance or their behavior, how that affected the jury. The jury, quite frankly, may have felt that that was very damaging against my client. But I can't say that. But all I know is this. It was some of the most bizarre behavior in court by any witnesses I've ever seen. I didn't know. Usually you get a chance to probe a little bit to see where the weak leg is going to be and where you can push against. I had no idea. I was pretty much flabbergasted when these people came into court. So because, and the prosecutor was too, and because of that, these 3507 statements were absolutely key. Because, I'll be very frank with the court, their demeanor during the 3507 statements was considerably different than their behavior in court. It was calmer to a large degree. But by the time they made those statements, according to their testimony, and the court gave them some credit for this, they had been threatened with arrest. Now, I know that the law is, if a promise to do something doesn't affect voluntariness for 3507 statements. But I believe that's different than a threat to lock you up if you don't make a statement. And I think that if the court believes that a threat was issued, and I think that the trial court actually did believe that, you can't avoid the impact by saying, well, the law is that I probably could have locked you up anyway.
Right. Well, let's come back to Justice Berger's question. Let's assume hypothetically the 3507 statements come in. Is the admission of the statement to the New York police officers harmless or reversible error?
It's reversible error. The statements to the police officers still went with the 3507 statements, while better than the court testimony, still were not persuasive. These witnesses still have a lot of problems.
So your argument is based on the disparity between their court testimony and the 3507 statements, the jury could have picked one, and you can't say it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt that they could have only come out one way.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Mr. Capone, getting back to, I'm not sure how best to characterize it, the causation issue or the but-for issue, let's assume hypothetically that the evidence is an equipoise on that question. Who has the burden?
The state has the burden by preponderance of the evidence. They've got to show.
Do you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, David. Please, the court.
Good morning, Mr. Donovan.
To go first to harmless error, I suppose I'm going to make a concession here. I find it hard to believe in this case how a out-and-out, I-did-it kind of confession to two disinterested police officers can ever be considered harmless error. Now, admittedly, the defendant made another confession to his girlfriend. And I don't know really how she came off as a particularly credible witness or not, but the other evidence, was there, certainly, but the out-and-out confession to two disinterested cops, I did it and this is why, it's hard for me to to see the admission of that as error, and I didn't argue harmless error in the brief. I realize I don't have to, but still, this isn't, I didn't take that as a fallback position, or obviously my concession is certainly not binding on the court. And I'd like to say another preliminary matter, and that's about the juvenile. Yes, Detective Higa, if I'm saying that correctly, was questioned by Mr. Capone about how you treat juveniles. And he did say, well, we, day 24, say, well, it depends on ages and crimes, can't go into a regular room, can't go into a holding cell, can't interrogate without his parents present. And the next page, was my client placed in that room? Answer, no, he was not a juvenile. And then another question, and then light bulb goes off, and he goes, hey, you know what? Maybe your juvenile is a different age. My juvenile is 15. 16 is treated like an adult. So in the New York cop's mind, this guy who was 17, close to 18, was an adult, and he was treated like an adult. Now, whether that played in DeClementi's mind when she went up to interrogate him, I don't know. She obviously knew he was a juvenile, but maybe being in New York City, the guy is in New York, he's an adult. Maybe she decided New York law obtained. I really don't know. There was no, yes.
Did she know that he had been indicted?
I'm assuming she did. I don't know why she wouldn't know that. But again, that's an assumption on my part.
Let's work with that assumption.
Sure.
And based on the record at trial, the state agreed she should not have questioned him.
The state conceded a Sixth Amendment violation at some point. They mentioned Sixth Amendment violation.
Now, given the record, and I mean, the state gets high marks for candor at trial and on appeal. But at trial, the state said he was still fired up. And as my earlier question showed, he could have started out by saying, and by the way, that officer from Wilmington got it wrong. Given the temporal connection and the transitional connection that he's continuing explaining his conversation with her, what's the state's argument for complete separation and this is a spontaneous statement that should come in?
Court said earlier during Mr. I wrote it down in quotation marks, continuation by way of explanation. And my immediate thought was that if the New York cops had been privy to this conversation, to the interrogation, that would be a problem. That would definitely be a problem, that now in the car with the cops who had known what was going on, who had heard everything he said, he wanted to go on and talk some more. But Higa and Marshal Deputy McMahon were not present in there. They were simply there to transport him. They had no interest in the case whatsoever. They didn't go in the interrogation room. Higa showed DeClementi where the interrogation room was, says, you know, go for it. And then he and McMahon left. So they had no idea what went on in there. They know he wanted for a first-degree murder out of some place called Delaware. They have no interest in the case whatsoever. I kind of wish there was a suppression hearing regarding the other statement, although I see why nobody wanted to put it in evidence. I mean, it would have been a redaction from practically impossible to redact. I mean, he just blabbers on and on and on about this, that, and the other thing. I'm not so sure there was a Sixth Amendment violation, but there was a concession that way. But again, in Patterson versus Illinois, just because a person's indicted, so long as he doesn't have a lawyer and hasn't actually requested counsel, Miranda warnings are sufficient to constitute a waiver of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And DeClementi did read him his Miranda warnings. But
Let's make sure we understand the state's position. As I understand the state's position at trial and on appeal, it is an acknowledgement that there was a Sixth Amendment violation. So we're not in the situation of, I don't know whether it's a Sixth Amendment violation. The state's position is there was a Sixth Amendment violation. Everything that preceded the statement in the car is inadmissible as a violation. However, what happened in the car is a separate and distinct spontaneous statement that is admissible.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I thank the court for the correction. I was actually responding to Mr. Capone's argument, again, off the record, that there was something egregious that had happened, and I was simply responding to that. No, the court is correct, and I thank the court for the correction. There was a concession at trial, and obviously on appeal, that there had been some form of Sixth Amendment violation. And we're working, and I have worked, and the record, the trials has worked from that assumption. There had been a Sixth Amendment violation. Now, whether it was an egregious violation or not, there is no record as to that. But I think probably the key case, since we're in the fruit of poisonous tree land here, is Wong Sun, the classic Wong Sun case, which says, you know, this is not a but-for analysis.
All right, well, let's go with the statement by the state at trial that he was still fired up about the statement. So your argument has to be something to the effect, although he made this spontaneous declaration because he was still fired up about his interview, it's separate and distinct because.
There was no exploitation of anything. McMahon and Higa were just there driving. They said nothing to him. According to their testimony, they said nothing. The trial judge accepted that. They put him in the car. Higa got behind the wheel. McMahon got in the passenger seat, and they were driving to Central Booking. And Mr. Brown just blurts out, you know, that Deco Mendy, she doesn't know anything. She said, I shot him for this reason. That's not why I shot him. I shot him for that reason. You know, being Mr. Tough Guy in front of the New York cops. And so there was no exploitation of any primary illegality. The detectives, were unaware of what had gone on there and did absolutely nothing.
Well, Mr. Capone's argument has nothing to do with the New York police or exploitation. What he's saying is the statement was the continuation that is attributable to the fact that the conversation with DeClementi should have never taken place in the at all.
Right. And that is the concession on appeal, and at trial was that DeClementi should not have engaged in this interrogation, thus the violation, the constitutional violation by via the interrogation, Sixth Amendment violation.
Well, Mr. Capone's argument seems to be if she'd never had the conversation, he would never be saying she got it wrong. And the record reflects the New York policeman didn't question him before she arrived, and didn't even question him in the car. So if we're talking about a statement being admitted, the only reason we even have a statement is because DeClementi questioned him when she should not have done that.
Yes, and that, I think, is why the United States Supreme Court courts of this state have made clear that it's not a but-for. It's not strictly a cause-and-effect analysis. There has to be that exploitation of the primary illegality, as was the case in Wong Sun. And Wong Sun made clear, the United States Supreme Court says a number of times, it has to be by exploitation of the primary illegality, and as was the case in Wong Sun. But they do emphasize, and the courts of this state have emphasized, there must be some state action. There must be some exploitation by a state actor, whether that's putting an informant, as is often the case, in the jail cell to act as a state agent. There has to be some kind of state action to elicit this this evidence, whatever it is, whether
it's
physical.
Is exploitation really the determinative test? Because we have other situations where someone makes a statement and it's acknowledged there's a Fifth Amendment violation. During the course of the statement, however, they disclose where the evidence is. And the police go and find the evidence, and the argument is you can't admit the evidence you found that's attributable
to the statement that shouldn't have taken place. And so by analogy, what Mr. Capone is arguing is you shouldn't get to admit the statement that's a continuation of a conversation that should have never occurred.
Right. Well, that's the Wong Sun. The evidence is the Wong Sun case where the police actually take what, not Wong Sun, but the co-defendant, Mr. Toy, said, and go and find the drugs. And the court said, well, that, the fact that they're using that and physically going and finding the drugs is exploitation of the primary illegality. There the police do something. They take the information that they obtained illegally from Mr. Toy and use that information to go find the drugs. The Christian Burial case of Roy V. Williams first time around. They use the functional equivalent of interrogation in that case. Wouldn't be nice if this little girl could have a good Christian burial and, you know, play on the defendant's heartstrings, and he finally says, I'll show you where he's buried. You know, then they go and find the body. So that is the discovery of that evidence is through exploitation of the primary illegality.
Mr. Donovan.
Yes, sir.
Earlier in your presentation, you stated that it placed great emphasis on the fact that the two New York policemen who were transporting Brown after the interrogation were not present during the interrogation. And you went on to say that had they been present in the interrogation, that would have been a problem for you.
Yes.
Why is that?
Because of Justice Holland's statement, continuation by way of explanation. If they had been present, I think the argument could be raised that, well, this is simply, he's just continuing along. Even if the officer had simply been present and not asked questions, they would have been part of that interrogation team, and maybe after the official interrogation ended, he wanted to keep on talking to the interrogators, and had they been present, they could be, even if they had said nothing during the interrogation, had they been present and in his line of vision, he could regard them as interrogators and may wish to explain something that he said previously and gone on. But
So they would have been reasonably or could have been reasonably perceived as interrogators.
Yes.
Thereby strengthening the argument that this is a further explanation to interrogators.
Exactly, and the fact that they were not present and really knew absolutely nothing of what happened there and said nothing in the police car,
this is a question, not a statement, that Mr. Brown could not have reasonably perceived them as interrogators.
No.
And is that at the core of your argument? That there was a break here between the interrogation and...
That is certainly part of it. And just what the trial judge said also, that although we're not talking about a great temporal break, we are talking about a change of location from the station house to the police car and a change of personnel. He's out now. He's no longer in the custody of Wilmington. I mean, no longer in the presence, never in the custody, but no longer in the presence of Wilmington. Now he's back with the New York cops and the United States Marshal. There's been a total change in circumstances, and this is one of the factors that the trial judge relied upon in finding that the spontaneous statement in the police car was admissible, regardless of any prior constitutional violation in the interrogation.
Well, I suppose that if Mr. Brown had been legally trained and knew the difference between the jurisdiction of a Delaware officer, police officer interrogating in New York, and New York policemen who were not involved in the interrogation, that argument might be valid. But
well, I don't think he has to have
that
training.
Kind of sophistication to a person in Mr. Brown's position.
No, I'm simply saying he's no longer. He knows he's no longer with the Wilmington police. He's back with the New York cops, so he's the people who want him for murder are no longer around him. Detective Higa's statement to him after he made that statement was, "You realize I'm an NYPD detective, don't you?" Saying, you know, hey, wait a minute, guy, you know, you may think that, you know, we're just your buddies here or something, but we're cops too, you know. don't say anything else, please. He thought he was in a place of relative safety, I suppose, that these two cops, because they're not Wilmington cops, or he can tell them whatever he wants, and they're, for some reason, not gonna spill the bean back to the Wilmington police.
But this is also in the context where, as opposing counsel pointed out, the defendant sat for 5 hours and didn't say a word to any of the New York police officers. So at some point before he started being interrogated, he was of the mind that I shouldn't be talking to people.
I would assume so. Well, of course, the New York police didn't ask him any questions. They had nothing to ask him. His New York charges were both gun-related. They were because he had a gun on him when he was arrested. So nothing to question him about there. So they had no interest in questioning him about anything. So he probably sat there for the 4 or 5 hours it took for the Wilmington police to get up there, saying nothing, probably alone in a room somewhere in a holding cell. Well, I think I've made my position clear on that first argument of the court. I probably have a minute or so left. If the court has any questions about any of the other...
Well, tell us the state's position. Elaborate on your position in the brief on why these statements were voluntary or why there's some standard of review that requires deference to the superior court's determination of voluntariness.
I think there's a real distinction that must be made here between... their courtroom appearance, which was decidedly involuntary. I mean, Ms. Clark had to be slapped in jail and under $10,000 bail, and Joanne Brown wasn't much happier about being there. So that was certainly involuntary. There was no doubt about that. However, all the evidence was that these two witnesses contacted the police to begin with. And now they may very well, and Ruth Ann Clark particularly, wanted to, you know, do a little dealing here because Ruth Ann, anyhow, was pending some shoplifting charges and thought maybe she could get some kind of deal, and so she was going along. But there was no indication on this record that, every indication is that these two witnesses, they initiated contact with the police, and... that they agreed to make the recorded statements, probably both hoping for some kind of deal now or in the future. Now, when it came time to actually go into court, you don't snitch culture had taken over, and they basically feigned their extreme reluctance and said a lot of stuff that the trial judge just rejected, and I think rightfully so. But that's basically the state's position, that they approached the police, that what they said, their statements to the police were voluntary. It's later that they started digging their heels in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I rarely use my own bottle. I think I'm going to be in jeopardy this time. But let me start off with the exploitation issue. I disagree on the law with my opponent on this issue. I think that there's two ways that a statement could be ruled inadmissible. One is by exploitation, or if there's a linkage in terms of time and situation. And I would ask the court to look at footnote 39 in the Caldwell case, which was the case cited by the state. And it basically says, whether granting establishment of the primary illegality, the evidence to which the instant objection is made has been come at by exploitation of the illegality, or instead by means sufficiently distinguishable to be purged by the primary taint. And that would be the passage of time. So it's an either-or thing. Either type of situation can cause a statement to be suppressed.
And that's consistent with the cases that talk about the term fruit of the poisonous tree.
Yes. Now, Your Honor, one last thing. We talked about the fact that the officers really didn't know what this case was about, and they didn't care what was going on with this case. And I think as the court is recognizing, It's not important what was in their mind, but what's important was in the mind of Andrew Brown. And these officers, these two New York City officers, these were the guys that kicked in the door of the apartment at 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning and arrested him, dragged him out of the apartment, brought him to a police station, locked him up, and kept him there for 5 hours. In his mind, they were involved with the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.